Before we get started with the next session, I would like to make some introductions. But unfortunately, our clergy are so pastoral, they're still out there talking. So, the first one, in order of seniority, he was here, but I don't see him now. Where did Father Joseph go? Father Joseph Corrigan, did he just... Okay. Yeah, just round everyone up. Say, come. They're not here, so it's hard to make introductions of people who are not in the room.
I tried to tell everyone it's time to start.
Meanwhile, while we're waiting for them to come in, this next session will run up for about an hour till 12:30, and then we'll take a lunch break. When we do take the lunch break, we will go outside and say the blessing over the food outside, and then they're preparing it now, so it'll come to pass. Okay, now we start seeing some men in black with beards. There we go. And Father Joseph Corrigan, we're waiting for him. Just looking a little bit later in the afternoon, we have sessions, and then we have Vespers at 5:30. That's looking further. Is there any other announcements while we're waiting for Father Joseph to come in? Then? Okay.
Oh. So tomorrow afternoon, after liturgy, kind of during our agape meal time, we will be offering another question and answer session, just in case you don't have time or you don't have all your questions in order. We welcome you to come back if you so choose, and we'll be back here in the nave in the afternoon around coffee hour time. So,
all right. Well, I'm going to make some introductions now out of order. Yes, go ahead.
I just was wondering if there's going to be a recording available
for people who are here. Yes, two thumbs up. Okay. Let me start by introducing Father John Finley. Would you stand, Father? This Father John is a well-known and good friend of our parish over many years. He is the chairman of the Department of Missions and Evangelism for the Antiochian Orthodox Archdiocese of North America. Father John, welcome. And keep up the good questions, Father. Now my wife's occupying you.
Sorry, what?
No, don't be sorry. 43 years of happy marriage. Father Michael Reagan is the pastor, the rector of St. Barnabas. Many of you come from the church, St. Barnabas Church in Costa Mesa. Father Michael, welcome.
Thank you.
And we look for you to weigh in at appropriate times as you feel suited. Okay, Father? Father John Mahfouz is one of our younger, newer priests. He has been recently appointed as rector of St. Matthew's Church in Redondo Beach. No, Torrance, California. You want to move even closer to the beach? And Father John, I've known since he was a young, well, kind of just even before he came to his majority. I remember him being a very serious young man at parish life conferences. So Father John joins us after having spent time in Salt Lake City with our church there. So welcome back to Southern California, belatedly, but in a public forum like this, it's a good one. Father Joseph Corrigan, I guess, is still not in the room. He and his wife, Robin Esther, Korea Robin Esther, they are the founding clergy of St. Peter the the Apostle Orthodox Church, this church. And he is now attached to St. Andrew's Church in Riverside as an associate priest. And they live up the hill, up the 15. And it's great to have them with us today. Did I skip any priests? I think that covers all that I've seen come into the church this morning. Elizabeth, you're on.
I have a tough act to follow here. So anyway, we're going to talk a little bit about caregiving because, you know, leads right into the dying question here. And then after lunch, we'll get into the nitty-gritty that you all really want to hear about. But how many people in here are currently a caregiver or have done caregiving for a parent, a husband, a wife, brother, sister, child? So we have a lot of people in here. Pat yourself on the back. It's a hard job. So I was the primary caregiver to all my mother, my father, his parents, my grandmother. We had three in-laws, like Mark said, that lived in our home over a period of 7 years. We planned for years before they came to live with us. We knew that we were going to be the primary caregivers. I have many brothers and sisters. He has one brother. We knew that none of them were going to help. And my brothers and sisters made it very clear that they were not going to help. Put them in a nursing home. We just can't deal with that. So, you know, we received plenty of advice and criticism from the family, but our sons were the only ones that actually helped us. So we planned for several years. We saw what was coming. So we sold our pretty much brand new two-story house that the kids could ride to the beach and moved into a bigger house in a not-so-nice neighborhood, but it was all, you know, mostly all on one floor. And we remodeled it into a nursing home over several years. So Father Grossman from Dallas was just in our house a couple of weeks ago, and he heard this talk, and he says, wow, this is a nursing home. And he was checking out the bathrooms, and we basically remodeled it into a nursing home. It doesn't look so much now unless you know what to look for. But so we were really preparing for this. What we didn't prepare for is we had three parents move in within 2 weeks of each other. I was still working. I had a pretty lucrative job. My dad's nurse came with him. My in-laws didn't realize they were staying. It's kind of a long story, but his mother had Alzheimer's. His father was supposed to be caring for her, promised to get nursing care. Ended up the lady, Orthodox lady next door was taking care of my mother-in-law because she had lost like 70 pounds and was... My father-in-law didn't have the mental capacity to take care of them. And so we picked them up halfway from Raleigh, and they thought they were coming for Pascha. When they got there, it's like, you're not going home. So we had everybody all at once. And my father-in-law, he didn't want to pay for nursing help. So he says, well, your nurse can take care of Louise too, and I can take care of myself. So we really started out with no help because my dad's nurse said, no, I'm not dealing with this, and she left. She was out of there. And every time I hired somebody, my father-in-law would fire him. He just didn't feel like, he felt like he could take care of everybody while I was working. So I quickly found out I needed to quit my job. So I did quit my job and stayed home. But just want to say, taking care of parents or loved ones at home is not for everyone. It's very stressful. Like I said, I started out really with no help, and I burned out quickly. I was crying all the time. The last straw was one day I thought I would hurry up, take a shower. Everything was relatively quiet. You know, when you're just dealing with two people with dementia that hallucinate, you don't have a lot of quiet time. So I was up taking a shower. I ran downstairs. The doorbell rang. It was our mail lady. She was really nice. And she said, your mother-in-law's climbing over the back fence. It's a brick wall, actually, about this high. Now, Louise was totally out of her mind and couldn't talk, but she was healthy. She walked 5 miles a day before she came to live with us, and I couldn't keep up with her. But she was climbing over the back wall. And I went to get her and bring her back in the house, and I saw my dad like two blocks down the street. So my father-in-law thought it was actually going to be pretty funny to let him out of the house. So I ran down, drove down and got my dad. I said, Dad, where are you going? I'm going to Pittsburgh to see my dad. I'm late. So I said, well, get in the car. I can get you there much faster. So I got him in the car. You have to use a lot of psychology when you're dealing with stuff like that. You know, got him back into the house and had a come-to-Jesus talk with my father-in-law. And I had to tell him, you know, if you don't get with the program, I'm putting Louise in a nursing home. And that was his biggest fear. I didn't have any control over him. He was still craziness driving back and forth to Raleigh thinking he was going to pack his house up. But that really got to him, that he knew I was serious at that point, that I would put her in a nursing home if he was going to fight me every step of the way. And that kind of, so we started hiring help. We started out with 3 or 4 hours a day. And in the last 3 years, we had caregivers 16 hours a day, and we kind of took turns with the night shift. You know, many people have made comments, oh, there's a special place in heaven for you. Your place is assured in heaven. I want to tell you, I went to confession more times while the parents were there than all other times put together. I mean, it's true. It is fraught with spiritual peril. But would I do it again? In a heartbeat. You know, in a lot of retreats, people ask about, you know, we actually talk about caregiving for everybody, but the elderly have always had a special place in my heart. Back from when I was, you know, 18 years old, working in a hospital, and they always put me in the geriatric ward because I couldn't deal with the elderly people. But, you know, a lot of times we get asked about caring for loved ones with dementia. And now, as we have this aging population, dementia's become a real problem. You know, people are living longer. But dementia is a general term for memory loss and other intellectual abilities serious enough to interfere with daily life. So, you know, I'd like to address this in the beginning. If your loved one has cancer or, you know, another diagnosis, the doctor may say, well, you have 4 to 6 months to live, or tell the family, and you have time to make plans. You know, you call hospice, decide whether you're going to keep them at home, put them in a facility, what are you going to do? But with dementia, it's not that easy, because somebody with dementia gets sicker by the inch, not by the day. And it's very hard to make that decision. When to call in home health, when to place them into a facility if that's your choice, or especially when it's time to call a hospice in. You know, with dementia, there's so many things to deal with. When do you have to take the checkbook away from them? When do you have to take their car away? When do you have to decide that they are no longer safe in their home? My dad kept on having electricity and all the utilities turned off because he didn't need them anymore and he wasn't going to pay for it. So we moved my brother in with him at that point. And I had all the utilities put in my name with a note on there that nobody could turn them off but me. But, you know, you may already be a caregiver and not realize it. Do you wake at night to help your husband or other family member to the bathroom? Do you arrange your schedule to fit your mother or father's doctor's appointment? So if you're doing that, you're not alone. You know, according to the National Alliance for Caregiving, at least 44.4 million adults provide the care that is critical in helping friends and loved ones with illnesses remain in their homes and other community settings. It is estimated that 80% of all care received by older Americans is provided by family members, spouses, children, grandchildren, and other relatives, you know, people just like you. It is a big decision to take care of your loved one at home, and it is not for everyone. Many outsiders feel that caring for an aging parent or a spouse is a duty that is handed to you by way of relationship, and it's your obligation to fulfill it. That is not true. Even in marriage vows, the in sickness and in health does not state you must be take on the role of a caregiver. Only that you will uphold your vow to continue to love, honor, and cherish. On the OCA website, they have something that says intense heavy-duty caregivers, especially spousal caregivers, do not get consistent help from other family members. One study has shown that as many as 3/4 are going it alone. Sadly, 61% of intense caregivers have experienced depression. 1/3 of all caregivers describe their own health as fair to poor, often indicating they are not sure they're going to outlive their loved ones. In those cases, there's two people at risk. And special vigilance is needed for those that live in remote or rural areas. In Alaska, there's a saying from Alaskan native elders when there is a crisis. It's that they say, who will cross the river with me? It is a question that's also applicable to family caregivers, no matter where they may live. Who's going to cross the river with me? So, you know, you have to think about some things. Are you a nurturer? not everybody is. What is your primary motivation for accepting the role? Is it family obligation, guilt, love, pressure? A lot of times pressure is placed on the oldest sibling or the one that's not married or has no kids to be the caregiver. If you need help, is there help available and will you ask for it? Now, I mean, do you know your limitations? Is there enough money available for outside help if necessary? Are you able to set boundaries? Are you able to keep those boundaries? Do you have family to care for, and how would they handle another person in the home? So if you have children or teenagers, how's that going to affect their life? Is your home appropriate for aging parents? If it's not appropriate, can you remodel it? Do you have unsolved anger towards the person for whom you will care? Have you ever been sexually or physically abused by that care recipient? Are you physically healthy and strong? You know, part of that job description for caregiving is often heavy lifting involved. Are there special skills you're going to need? I mean, maybe insulin shots. Somebody might have a feeding tube if they're undergoing cancer treatment. Bed sores. How about changing diapers? How's your gag reflex? You know, it's not for everybody. Can your loved one contribute financially? And if not, can you or your siblings contribute? And are there enough support systems in your community? And we're going to talk about that. Do not count on your church family to help with caregiving. Everybody has their own life and problems, short term maybe, but not long term. You cannot expect that. So, you know, learn as much as you can. Understanding what to expect will help you care. Plan your care, help you plan for care and transitions. You know, knowledge will help you both honor and love a loved one's strength and capabilities through each stage, and make sure you have the strength and resources to carry on. Just remember, don't take the journey alone. Nobody can be awake and alert 24 hours a day. You have your own health and other obligations to consider. So having support and caregiving is the key, whether it be from other family, in-home health, respite care, or making the decision to move your loved one to assisted living and nursing homes. And also take safety measures. There are a lot of things to consider while caring for your loved one at home. You know, most accidents in the home occur during daily activities, eating, bathing, using the bathroom. So you have to take precautions like checking the water temperature or checking the temperature of food. Sometimes it's hard for them to tell the difference between hot and cold. You know, putting walk-in showers or grab bars, putting texture stickers. If somebody has dementia, I mean, are you a hunter? Do you have firearms? You need to make sure they're locked up. Use appliances with automatic shutoff. We had to actually install deadbolts and put a key by each door because my mother-in-law rattled the doors so hard trying to get out to escape that she would rattle the door knob right off. So we had to do that and put a key close by every door so we could open it if there was a fire. Mm-hmm. But maybe you might have to install a hidden gas valve or circuit breaker or remove knobs, you know, remove throw rugs. But when is it time to consider placing your loved one in a facility? I mean, this is always very difficult and guilt-ridden. Mm-hmm. You have to know your limitations. Is your loved one becoming unsafe? Do they wander? Do they have trouble with stairs? Again, is the health of the patient at risk and the caregiver? Are they at risk? Is that person beyond your physical capabilities, you know, the lifting and that type of thing? Is the caregiver becoming stressed, irritable, impatient? I did that a lot. Are they neglecting work, family, and self? Sometimes you have to wonder, would the structure and social interaction at a care facility benefit a person? A good example is Mark's Aunt Betty. She was a diabetic, and she had some dementia. Her husband, Pete, suffered from cancer, and he was getting a little dementia, too, and they were living alone. Their kids lived in D.C., and the big thing is, oh, Betty won't take care of herself. She won't take her insulin. She won't eat right. But when Pete died, they moved her in a facility, in Virginia near where the kids lived. She thrived because they had her on a diet. They gave her her insulin. And in the house, she was isolated and had isolated herself and was by herself. In the facility, she was dancing. They had exercise programs. They had art programs. And she thrived there. She was happier than she had been in years. But just remember, not all hospitals, assisted living, nursing homes, and hospices are created equal. You have to do your homework. A lot of times, where your family member ends up is where the social worker at the hospital recommends they be discharged to. That does not mean they're the best one. My mother-in-law, I'll get to that later. I'll be redundant. I don't want to do that. But just do your homework. You know, get referrals. There's a Medicaid nursing home finder. It has reviews on all the facilities. You know, you can't expect everything to be perfect, but you want them in the upper tier. Take a tour. You know, make arrangements to meet with the nursing home administrator and take a tour of the facility. You know, are they engaging the patients? Or is everybody in bed? Or are they all just lined up in the hall in a wheelchair and there's no activities and they're just, you know, not doing anything? Do the parking lot test. That's a good one. At visiting hours, talk to visitors and say, you know, are you visiting your loved one? If somebody gets out of the car, how do you like it here? Ask the employees, would you put your mother here? But, you know, one thing, you know, I'm telling you, it's all right to put them in a nursing home, but just remember that thousands of Americans, you know, our elderly mothers, fathers, and grandparents are being killed each year in nation's nursing homes. They're victims of premature and preventable death. This quiet pandemic is rarely detected by government inspectors, investigated by law enforcement, appraised by medical examiners, or prosecuted by anybody. These are not crazed angels of death. Most are caused by fatal neglect traced to caregivers upon whom the residents depend on for food, liquid, and turning them in their beds so they don't get bed sores. And this is according to leading researchers in elder care. I'm not really blaming this on the aides or the people that actually work in the nursing home, because they are for profit. And if you look, it's impossible for one nurse's aide. Well, usually they have 9 to 13 patients. And if it's assisted living, that's one thing. But in a nursing home, out of those, let's say they have 10 patients, 5 of them probably need fed. And they have 1 hour to do it. My mother-in-law took 1 hour to eat, at least. She ate very slow. And you had to have patience. So, you know, they just don't have the time. Water's seldom offered if it's not with a meal. It's all about the money. There's just never enough staff. So just after they're admitted, you have to stay vigilant. You know, visit at different times on different days. Make sure they're eating or being fed. Going back to where the first time Louise, my mother-in-law, was in a rehab center, she had a series of urinary tract infections that just really wore her down, and she almost ended up dying from it. But the nursing home they recommended, first night she was there, they stole all of her clothes. The aides stole her clothes, and then we went in the next day, she had bruises all over, and they said, oh, she was fighting us. So we took her out of there. But when she broke her hip, we put her in a better facility. We did our research, but like I said, she took an hour to eat, and we thought they were taking good care of her, and she started just dropping weight like crazy. So we had either one of our aides or us at every meal to feed her, to make sure that she ate, because she couldn't take care of herself. She couldn't feed herself. So, you know, make sure you know those staff members on a first-name basis. You know, make sure you go to the care plan meetings. And let go of the guilt, you know. If you plan the move with your loved one in advance, there's still guilt and self-doubt. Am I doing the right thing? I've heard people say to me, you did it. You took care of 3 of them. Why can't I just take care of 1? Well, we had a perfect situation. Our parents had money. You know, they had great pensions. So we were able to do that. Our house was set up perfectly as a nursing home. So, you know, it was just a perfect situation. That doesn't always happen. So let go of the guilt and do what you have to do. Just make sure that they're being taken care of. But I just want to tell you about some things that are available. And besides getting your paperwork in order, you might want to talk to an elder care attorney and work on getting them qualified for Medicaid and veterans benefits and that type of things. Do you know the VA has aid in attendance for veterans who served at least 90 days active duty in a period of war? It used to be only for World War II veterans. Now it includes Gulf War veterans. They get a pretty substantial amount of money every month that you can use to pay yourself to take care of them, hire help in, or pay a nursing home. So it can run up to, I think my dad got close to $2,000 VA aid in attendance.
A month?
Yeah, I mean $2,000 a month, yeah. I don't know. It depends. It, you know, a lot of it depends.
It was a huge help.
Yeah, it was a huge help. In California, you have Medi-Cal. That'll pay for home health and nursing homes if medically necessary. They have to be low income to get that. Medicare will not pay for a nursing home unless they're in there for rehab. If they break a hip or something, they can go into a nursing home for rehab for 21 days. Sometimes that can be extended if they show notable improvement, but it's not a long-term situation. There's home health that is paid for by Medicare. And most insurances, if it's deemed medically necessary, they'll come in and help with bathing, occupational therapy, speech therapy. The Alzheimer's Association, if you're dealing with somebody with Alzheimer's, is a wonderful resource. And then I'm sure there's local organization that might offer some respite grants. Alzheimer's Association, I don't believe, are offering respite grants as much as they used to, but I know hospice does. They will lot up with hospice care. It pays for 1 week every 6 months, I believe, for them to go into a facility so you can take a break. So there's a lot of stuff people don't know. So, you know, just seek help. You know, accept offers of help. If people want to help, you know, suggest specific things that people can do to help you. Can you go to the store for me? Can you pick up some medicine? You know, learn how to communicate with doctors effectively. Take respite breaks a lot. Watch for signs of depression. Don't delay getting medical help if you need it. You know, organize your medical information so it's up to date and easy to find. And again, make sure your legal documents are in order. And just give yourself credit for doing the best that you can do. And I want to talk a little bit about end-of-life care, if I'm not boring anybody to death. But the end-of-life is defined as a period when healthcare providers would not be surprised if death occurred within 6 months. So older Americans with chronic illness think about how they would prefer their lives to end. They want a good death. So people used to die at home. But with the success of medicine, people now live past their expiration dates. You know, death is as natural as birth, and dying a natural death has become unnatural. You know, people want to be surrounded by their loved ones and know their life has meaning. You know, studies indicate at least 80% of patients wish to avoid hospitalization at the end of their lives, yet it only happens about 20% of cases. And it's so sad for me to think of someone who's dying hooked up to IV fluids and ventilators or still getting antibiotics. Hospice is a great thing. But again, like I said, not a hospice. They're mostly for profit now. They're not all created equal. But hospice care, a lot of people think, oh, that's a death sentence. But it's critical to note, and it's well documented, for individuals to stabilize with hospice care and even graduate out. People with progressive diseases, such as Parkinson's or dementia, may cycle in and out of hospice as their health actually gets better. So, you know, hospice started back in 1967 at St. Christopher's Hospital in London, and that's where they first used the term hospice to describe specialized care for dying patients. So today, hospice care provides humane and compassionate care for people in the last stages of incurable disease, so they live as fully and comfortably as possible. My first, I never really even thought about hospice much until my mother was dying. My mother had breast cancer, which they were way undertreated. They did a little bit of radiation, told her she was fine. It went to her brain, and the doctor suggested that hospice come in the house. And they were invaluable. So, you know, hospice is a philosophy of care. It's a philosophy or viewpoint that accepts death as the final stage of life. It's to help patients live their last days as alert and pain-free as possible. They try to manage symptoms so the person's last days may be spent with dignity and quality surrounded by their loved ones. Hospice affirms life and neither hastens or postpones death. Like I said, they're not all created equal. We talked about this at dinner a little bit last night. Hospice care creates or treats the person rather than the disease. It focuses on quality rather than length of life. It's family-centered and includes the patient and the family in making decisions. You know, many people don't think about hospice to the end. However, accessing hospice earlier can improve the quality of life of your loved one. They might already be eligible for compassionate care services if they refuse to eat, become nonverbal, have additional health problems like aspiration pneumonia, bed sores. So according to a study by Duke University in 2012, more than 24,000 hospice enrollees with dementia found that 5% were discharged from the service because their health stabilized or improved. My mother-in-law, my dad cycled in and out 3 times. So those who outlive their hospice stay are more likely to be women younger than 85 who have been in hospice care for more than 180 days. So hospice and palliative care, comfort care, is provided under Medicaid, Medicare, and most private insurances. Comfort care is designed as a treatment designed to relieve or reduce the intensity of uncomfortable symptoms without trying to cure the underlying disease. It could even involve the use of medicines and possibly surgery to control symptoms such as pain, nausea, or shortness of breath. The primary care doctor will help guide the patient through the transition to hospice care by providing the best estimates for a chance of recovery, identify situations where palliative care may be best, and at times giving permission for the patient or loved ones to forgo treatment. So, you know, hospice can provide nursing care. They have registered nurses to monitor symptoms and medication. They also help educate the family. Social services, we had a social worker. It's funny, we had so many people in our house. The poor little old man across the street, he thought we were running an illegal nursing home because he could not believe we had 3 parents living there and all the cars that were in the driveway. Because with hospice, you do get nursing, you get social working, you get home, you know, the nurse's aides that come in. The doctor doesn't come in, but they're involved. We also had, they have, what they don't call them, clergy, what do they call them?
The chaplain.
So we had a chaplain. So, and depending on how you want the chaplain to handle your loved one is up to you. So ours came in and she was great. She said, I really don't know anything about orthodoxy. By the time she was done, she had read her book and knows everything about orthodoxy. Couldn't get her to convert. But she asked us, what do you want me to do? How do you want me to deal with this? Do you want me to pray with them? We've said, you know, it'd be really nice if you would just sit and read them the Bible. You know, hold their hand and read them the Bible. And that's what they did. It was great. Home health aides to help with bathing, shaving, and that kind of thing. There's not so much trained volunteer support anymore because there's not a whole lot of nonprofit hospice anymore. So anyway, they also offer bereavement support. And, well, also respite care. It gives the family a break from intense caregiving. You can put them in a hospice facility for that, or you can have somebody come in the home, or you can put them in the hospital. So hospice care, a lot of times people think it has to be done at home, but there are hospice facilities, and the one I've been in are wonderful. Oh my gosh, they're so, they're just the inpatient ones. You can be in hospice in a nursing home. So if your loved one's in a nursing home, they can have hospice care come in, and they will make sure that the patient is being cared for through the end of life in the correct way. And like I said, bereavement support. So, but one thing I do want to mention, you know, well, Medicare regulations, let me go back some. So it's very hard for physicians to determine how long with anybody with a terminal disease has to live. It's especially hard with advanced dementia. Medicare regulations require a physician to certify that a patient entering hospice is likely to die of their disease within 6 months. So with dementia, it's very hard to determine when somebody's ready for hospice. So only 11% of people who die in hospice had the primary diagnosis of dementia. By comparison, more than 40% of Americans who die there are about 40% of Americans die each year in hospice care do not have dementia. You know, they can outlive the six-month period and be recertified. And again, it's not unheard of. Louise was in the hospital over a period of 3 years. So there's not a specific point in an illness when end-of-life care begins. It very much depends on the individual. In the case, like I said, of Alzheimer's disease, a patient's doctor will likely provide you with information on stages of dementia. It's general guidelines for understanding the progression of that disease and provide appropriate care. So for other life-limiting illnesses, following the following signs that you want to talk to your loved one about palliative rather than curative care options: are they making multiple trips to the emergency room, and their condition is stabilized but the illness continues to progress, affecting their quality of life? Have they been admitted to the hospital several times with the same or worsening symptoms? They wish to remain home rather than spend time in the hospital, or they have stopped receiving treatment for their disease. A lot of people, it's very controversial about pain at the end of life and the use of drugs and morphine. Watching someone you love die is hard enough, but thinking that they're in pain makes it worse. Not everybody who is dying experiences pain, but there are things that you can do to help someone who does. Experts believe that care for someone who is dying should focus on relieving pain without worrying about possible long-term problems of drug dependence or abuse. So don't be afraid of giving as much medicine as prescribed by the doctor. Somebody was telling the story last night about it was too much morphine.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you have to, like I said, all hospice are created equal.
Right.
A dear friend of mine, Mother LeBeau from St. Mary and Martha's Monastery, was dying. And Mother Thecla called me. I had called her several times. I said, "You guys need help. Let me come up and help you." "Oh, we got it. We want to take care of our own. We've got it." So I called her one day, and she started crying. She says, "When can you get here?" I said, "An hour and a half, if I drive fast." So I came. So I just kind of, we were caring, well, that's another story altogether. We used to care for mentally ill adults. So I had somebody at their doctor's appointment, had to take them home first. So it took me 2 hours. But anyway, she had made it clear that she didn't want too much pain medication because she wanted to be able to pray at the end of her life. She wanted to do that. But when I got there, she was so agitated and so much pain that it was just heartbreaking to watch her. And I said, "Mother Thecla, give her pain medicine." "Oh, no, she won't be able to pray." I said, "Just let's give her a little bit more at a time, just a little bit more at a time." And that settled her down. And she spent her last night, she had a little in her little bed, and I sat with her all night. She had her little icons on the wall so she could lay in bed and pray. And all night long, she's an Orthodox nun, but she said the Hail Mary all night long. And she couldn't get through it all. She was a former Catholic, and so was I. So she would start Hail Mary full of as much as she could, and I would finish it. And that's how she ended up her last night, being able to pray all night with just that little bit more of pain medication. So I'm going to skip that part. Oh, no. Let's see if I can do this in time and go over the paperwork. And I'm going to... You know, Orthodox Christianity, as from the beginning, appreciated that pain and distress can bring the dying to temptation and despair, thus leading them away from the whole heart of pursuit of salvation. You know, St. Basil the Great notes with approval that mandrake doctors give us sleep, with opium they lull violent pain. Indeed, twice in the liturgy, the Church prays for a Christian ending to our life, painless, blameless, peaceful, and a good defense before the fearful judgment seat of Christ. So struggling with severe pain can be very draining. It can make it hard for families to be together in a meaningful way. It affects mood. You know, if you're in pain, I know when I'm in pain, I'm short-tempered and angry. That pain may make it hard for them to talk and share thoughts and feelings. You know, what can we do at the end? Make them as comfortable as possible. And that includes helping them manage mental and emotional distress. You know, if they're alert, understandably, they could get depressed or anxious. You know, encourage conversations about feeling. They may have specific fears and concerns. Fear of the unknown or worry about those left behind. Some people are afraid of being alone at the very end. And this feeling can be made worse by the understandable reaction of families and friends who stop visiting because they just don't know what to say. You know, how do I deal with this? I have a friend right now that it's very hard. We went on vacation together. She's been my best friend forever. And had a major stroke. And she lost her verbal abilities, and she really can't walk anymore. But it's in the beginning, it was very difficult because she can't talk back. And then I realized we can communicate. And we have found a way, and I'm going up there in a couple weeks to West Virginia. But it does make it very hard, and a lot of her friends don't come around because they don't know what to do. Even her children have a problem with it because, you know, she wants to talk, and you can't understand anything she says. So, or somebody that's already beginning to grieve may withdraw. This can add to that person's sense of isolation. So that simple act of physical contact, holding hands, a gentle massage, a touch, can make a person feel connected to those he or she loves. People nearing the end of life may have spiritual needs as compelling as their physical needs. Maybe involving finding meaning in one's life and any disagreements with others. The dying person might find peace by resolving unsettled issues with family or friends. Visits from clergy bring comfort. My dad, he knew pretty much who I was till the end, on and off. He didn't know anybody else. He didn't know Father John Parker's name, but he knew when that black cassock walked in the house, the priest is here and I'm getting communion. Hello, Father. So it brought him a lot of comfort. And my mother-in-law always recognized him, too. They just recognized that cassock. So, you know, adult children can share how their father has influenced the course of their life. Grandchildren can let the grandfather know how much he has meant to them. Friends can relate how they value years of support and companionship. Share memories of the good times. And that is possible even if a patient's unconscious. They still may be able to hear. One of the worst things that ever, and it's embarrassing to say because my family's just crazy, but when my mother was dying, they were, you know, all gathered around, and then how much longer? My brother wanted to go to a hockey game, and he said, "You think I get to the hockey game and back in time?" And it was just like, she was laying right there. It's like, all of you leave. So She could hear what they were saying. I truly believe she heard everything they said. So always talk to that person, not about them. When my sons came in, they would say, "Hey, Frank, it's Josh. I've come to visit. I'm your grandson." Hey, Josh. Sometimes a person that's confused, that's dying, suddenly seems clear thinking. Take advantage of these moments. If they hallucinate, go with it. What they see is very real to them. And if they're seeing angels or their mother, who's dead, who are you to say they're not really seeing them at the end? When I first started working in hospitals, which is a very short amount of time, I went into training, then I went into another career, but there was a young boy, and his name was Freddie. I'll never forget Freddie. He was about eight. He was in foster care, and his foster mother had about nine kids of her own, but she was at the hospital every day with him while he had cancer, so he was in and out over a couple of years. When he was dying, I was in the room, along with several other nurses. I mean, he was our favorite. We just all love Freddie. And he said, "Do you see the angels?" And he says, "I'm surrounded by angels. There's angels everywhere." And then he died.
Wow.
So who are we to say that, I mean, anyway. And what did your Uncle John do? He did set up in bed and...
Yeah, he sat up at the last moment, made the sign of the cross, and laid back down.
Yep, and died. So, you know, I just want to talk about one last thing before we get into paperwork, and I'm sorry if I'm going too long.
No.
We're okay? A little bit about feeding tubes and hydration. If your loved one wants to drink and eat at the end, you have to provide that. So you have to nourish and hydrate them. But I learned this when my mother was dying. I really thought I could keep her alive longer if I could keep her eating and drinking. Mm-hmm. So I was forcing that food and water down her, and hospice says, "You gotta stop this, you're making her pain worse." So they gently told me to stop and explained about her body shutting down and that I was just making her more uncomfortable. It has been shown that continued hydration can increase the level of pain and discomfort in the dying. You will know when they refuse to drink or refuse to eat, then you just have to keep their lips, you know, hydrated, and maybe use some ice chips or swabs. But dehydration allows for the rapid increase in the production of ketones. These are a chemical substance in the brain, and it acts as a natural analgesic. How about antibiotics? Do your loved ones really need antibiotics at the end of their life? I have seen that so often. You know, my sister asked, "Well, are you still giving Dad his cholesterol and heart medicine and all that?" It's like, why? You know, it doesn't make any sense. You know, we don't want to prolong the pain and discomfort of a dying patient. Their use has deprived many terminally ill patients, use of antibiotics, of a relatively simple and painless death by pneumonia. I know that sounds hard to take.
Sure.
They used to call it an old man's best friend. Pneumonia was called an old man's best friend. So left untreated, the sufferer often lapses into a state of reduced consciousness, slipping peacefully away in their sleep, giving a dignified end to the period. End the period of life. So, you know, really think about artificial nutrition and hydration and that kind of thing. And the last thing I want to talk about is some people need permission to die, especially if they're worried about who they're leaving behind. They've got some guilt. They're holding on to some things. My mother did not have a peaceful death. The one thing that was really great is we had a wonderful priest. My mother was an atheist. My dad was Catholic. We have, you know, Mormons and Catholics, and now been Orthodox for 37 years. But anyway, Father John Crest did come and talk to my mother through her last 4 months and said, you know, she did find peace with God and not to worry about it. So he would come and say, "Get out." But she was so worried about my dad, who was already in the beginning stages of dementia. We didn't realize how bad he was until she died. And she knew, and she was worried about it. actually, as soon as she realized that she had a short amount of time to die, she went to an attorney and took care of everything, all the paperwork, so that when she died, we didn't have to do anything except take care of him. But she was so worried about his care that I just had to hold her hand, and I said, "Mom, I'm going to take good care of him. I promise you, Dad's going to have great care." And she's just, I said, "You just need to close your eyes and relax." And she closed her eyes and died within a matter of minutes. So sometimes people do just need that. And that's all I'm going to talk about. Does anybody have any questions?
Wow. Can I just follow up the thing about morphine? Mm-hmm. This is really a question, and maybe it's for a doctor. I hope you know the answer. But, you know, morphine will kill you, right? If you take too much,
yes.
It'll kill you fast.
Yes. Right? And unfortunately, a lot of people
so
hasten that along.
I wonder if how many accidents take place.
Quite
you know what I'm saying? So is there a way in, you know, this kind of paperwork or that we could make clear with hospice that don't kill me, try to keep me out of pain.
Not even
accidentally, I mean purposely, don't do this.
Yeah, and you know, I was just talking about this earlier. I don't know.
I mean, I'm for morphine.
Yeah. Well, you just have to really make sure that you have a good healthcare power of attorney that understands your needs. Make sure your family know what you want. I don't know if hospice would limit the amount of morphine that they would prescribe for you, because you have to have morphine in the house for your next dose.
I mean, when a cancer patient is, you know, in advanced stage,
use their own pump.
They've got the pack, but it'll only click so much. That's dialed in, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That'll only click so much per hour.
Yeah, there's been cases where I even wondered if my dad didn't hasten that along a little bit accidentally. Yes?
Yeah, maybe I can add something about morphine, Father.
Yes.
Yeah, morphine acts on the central nervous system, on the vital centers, and it's a suppressor. So by suppressing, it's suppressing pain. So that's basically why the healthcare givers of the healthcare protocols, the medical protocols, are given them to the patient the dose of morphine. They are established protocols. And because they are established, those are the legal protocols. And then once the doctor signs up, this is the protocol that needs to be followed, then the nurses have to follow that, because otherwise they are legally liable. What happens is typically those protocols are on an gradually increasing dose, because opioids are also, the body develops insensitivity towards opioids. That's why the dose needs to be increased. And at the same time, it's suppressing more and more. The vital centers have to do with respiration and the pace of the heartbeat. So everything gets suppressed. Typically, the patient at that point is not receiving nutrition and is not receiving fluids. Most specifically is the part of dehydration. Dehydration is also a suppressant to the vital centers. So everything goes down very quickly and gradually towards death. This is phrased typically with the wording of, we are making the patient more comfortable, because there is no room for sensation of pain under those circumstances. However, it is well understood in the biomedical field that morphine is suppressing the vital centers of the patient. Everybody knows that. It is not taught to the public because it's hears everybody. So the point is, once we get into the hospice cervix and the doctor signs up for morphine treatment, we are pretty much in their hands, and we can't do anything. Because we as caregivers or as next of kin, we might complain about that. No, I want to make sure that this is not going to happen. However, once the order is triggered, there is no way to stop it. Does it make clear?
You have
so
to have
the
a good
point
it's just that,
is whether
it's
we want,
too clear.
We want
it's
hospice or not.
No, it's very clear. Somehow we have to work, and I'm no expert on this, but we have to work on where's the line between hospice and euthanasia.
Well,
you just
have to have make sure
crossover
with a good hospice that has a good doctor on staff, has good nurses. If they're at home, it's up to you how much morphine you're going to give them. But I have a friend that's a quadriplegic. He has a morphine pump. And he drives. He just got a brand new, decked out monster truck, and he drives. And like I said, he's a quadriplegic, and it doesn't even affect him because he's in so much pain. It just takes the edge off.
Yes.
Who are you talking about?
Michael.
Oh, Michael Morgan. Yeah.
Yeah, Michael also is that way. Mother LaBeouf is another good example. You know,
just a little more.
If you've never had to deal with someone who's in terrible chronic pain, you don't realize that they can be on large doses of heavy-duty painkillers, and it just takes the edge off. It's just, and they're still in pain, a lot of them. Of course, what we're after and what we all hope for and work toward, hopefully you have a good rapport with your doctor and your hospice caregivers, and they're working toward the same thing, which is that balance where we're not in so much pain, but we're still conscious and can pray.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's what we all want. I want to be able to pray up to the last second like Mother Bob did. Whereas when she was in terrible pain, she couldn't pray at all. So we're looking for that.
I just want to say one thing about that. You just have to make sure that your hospice is a good one. We were lucky. We had a very good hospice where we could call the nurse and she would call right back. And towards the end, she was there all, you know, pretty much on and off all the time. She would call the doctor, change medications, do whatever she needed to do. You can, in hospice, ask for that medication to be reduced for your loved one. It really kind of depends. If they're in the hospital, sometimes that's almost impossible. But if they're in a good hospice or at home, then you have a little more control over that. But
let's take two more questions briefly,
yeah,
and maybe from people who haven't talked. Christina?
I just want to clarify, because I was part of that discussion last evening at dinner, and hospice was wonderful. They were wonderful. They met all of our needs. What they did was they gave us the morphine,
mm-hmm,
and they said, don't be afraid to give her what she needs to control her pain. So whenever she would carry on her moan and groan, we would give her more morphine. So it isn't that they had prescribed a large amount, but they had given us control over that. So, you know, when my son said, you're giving her too much, he was just correcting our overzealousness. So hospice was home health care.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was in the home. I don't know what went on in the hospital, but at home, we had pretty much control over it.
Yes, we had at home.
One more question. I'm just interested, I'm no expert, but we live in an era of recreational marijuana. Is that an effective painkiller and young use? Or I know the federal government's going to say,
I think so. I mean, it's not like I use it,
but
you know, CBD oil has been a big thing. But I think I learned back in the hospital, back in the day, we had a cancer doctor, Dr. Lee. He was Chinese. And, this was in the 70s. And there was no legal marijuana, medical marijuana, any of that. He came into the nurse's room where we did a report. Of course, back then we were all in there smoking. It was crazy back in the day. But he came in and he said, does anybody know how to roll a joint? We're like, what? And he said, I have a patient that I think marijuana would benefit greatly, and I would like somebody to teach her how to use it. So like everybody's hand went up. I didn't get to go. But I have a friend that had lung cancer, and the nausea was so bad that was the only thing that helped her. So can it help for pain? I really don't know how much that helps for pain. I know it helps for nausea, and it helps with epilepsy, which now they're using, you know, CBD oil, which doesn't have the THC in it. So
I'd like to just reinforce a couple of things that Elizabeth said. If you're making the decision to become a caregiver, or if you're in the midst of being a caregiver, you have to grant yourself the mercy to say, I can't do this. It's that serious. You really have it. It's the most difficult thing you will ever do. You need to hear what she said about her checklist. Can I do this? Can I do that? Do I have this? Do I have that? It's the most difficult thing you will ever do. And you have to, at some point, if you find yourself as a caregiver, you have to grant yourself the mercy to say, I can't do this anymore. It's done. They need to go to a facility. Second thing I'd like to, that she barely touched on, was respite care is the most important thing in the world.
Oh, I said like 10 times.
To a caregiver. Respite care is the most important thing in the world for a caregiver. If you can provide it for someone else, it's a great blessing to them and a great mercy. But you really have to take advantage of it, find it. Alzheimer's and other people have grants for it, and it is a lifesaver for a caregiver.
Lunch is ready, and we need to talk about these in like 5 minutes. So I want you to come up here, because actually, you, the OCA, well, you can tell them, because okay. Deacon Mark did these forms, a gift and another gift. And it doesn't really take too long to go over it, so I think we can do it in like 5 minutes or less.
We'll give it a shot. And we can answer questions.
Answer questions at lunch or after lunch?
Yeah, it's what we're here for. Put us to work, use it.
I think there might be four of you who don't have another gift for my loved ones.
There's two different ones.
We have two.
A gift and another gift.
There are.
So if anybody doesn't have another gift, and also one last thing, if you have one with a pink cover on it, you are the winner of a book. It was an accident.
Get the free button.
So come see us afterwards. Staples left one pink sheet in the copy paper. And there.
Okay. What you found on your chair is the culmination of a lot of years of work. In our first edition of A Christian Ending, we created a series of end-of-life forms, just about everything that you would need. Let me have a look here a second.
If anybody needs any of the forms, we have them back.
Anytime you go in the hospital, you're going to need a healthcare power of attorney. The healthcare power of attorney gives someone the authority to make decisions for you if you're incapacitated and can't make them for yourself. Then you can give it. They go by different names in different states, but it's the same thing. Is an advanced directive for health care or living will. That document tells the person you've appointed what it is you want them to do for you. It tells them when to withdraw care, when to, you know, everything from I want every possible measure taken, every extreme measure taken to keep me alive as long as possible, to when to shut off the respirator. And that's very important. They're absolutely vital. Most of us, I think, have seen in the paper issues that have happened with people whose directives were not clear. And I almost said wishes don't work in the legal world. It has to be a directive. You have to direct people what it is you want done. The the Roman Catholic Church several years ago, some of you may have seen this, if any of you are healthcare workers or you're active in this type of thing, they created a document called Five Wishes some years ago. We've seen it. In fact, it came around to several priests, and they thought, well, you know, I have some problems with this document theologically, but we need to do something like this for Orthodox people. What they were trying to do was create end-of-life critical care forms that their people could fill out that were not threatening. They were not psychologically threatening to fill these forms out. So they made it really nice and flowery, and they called it Five Wishes. Well, I already let the cat out of the bag. Wishes are not legal. So they took the Five Wishes and they said, we need to do this. My spiritual father is on the committee for the OCA that was tasked with doing this, so guess who got to write the forms? So we took our forms. I took the Five Wishes, sent it to my attorney. My attorney gave me a legal lesson and said, this form, these Five Wishes, this is worthless. It is unenforceable in a court of law. And he said, you have to have this, 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 and this. So these forms are not quite as user-friendly and non-threatening as the others were, but they really are a gift for my loved ones. They really are. And if you read that introductory letter to my loved ones at the beginning, you'll see what I mean by that. This is me taking the hard work off of you, my children.